Chapter 9. Rachab. Unbroken. Ambush. War Anvil travelled north, leaving the fires of the dead as a smear of red light in the thickening fog. They travelled through days and nights without noticing the boundaries between each. The surviving crew of War Anvil woke. Sasha did not regain consciousness, and her body remained slumped over the gun breech. The flats seemed to go on forever. Cord had a suspicion that Arago had made more than one navigation error. He did not say anything, nor did he blame the scout. How could he blame any of them anymore? They saw no other living thing. From his position back in War Anvil's turret, Cord watched the two green runes of his remaining command glide over a featureless plate of drying earth. Sometimes the fog outside the hull thickened, sometimes it thinned to almost nothing, and the light of sun, stars, or moon fell down on them. The wind brought dust as well, great rolling banks which enveloped them in seconds. The first time the dust had come, Cord had ordered a complete stop, and they had waited while the hull had whispered with the swishing voice of the dust. When the dust had cleared, it left them half buried beneath a black glass sky. As Cord had looked towards the promise of distant mountains, a great light had risen into the dark, strobing between blue and white, before vanishing and leaving glowing skeins of light that had scudded across the sky. Shornal had sworn that she had felt the earth shake through the hull. Cord had felt nothing. They had pressed on after that, the two tanks heaving themselves free of their shrouds of dust, and the desolation of days that were nights and nights that were days took them again. In the dark hours, Cord would sit and think of the reason why he had begun this journey into folly. His thoughts circled the images of the burning tanks, and he heard again all the warnings that he had not listened to. But even then the old thought surfaced. There had to be a reason. A reason why this had all happened. A reason why the present was as it was. A reason that explained it all. To admit anything else felt like a surrender. Time became difficult to measure, even with the numbers clicking over on War Anvil's Auspex. It was not that they could not measure the passing of days or weeks, but the information lacked meaning. Fuel, water, air and nutrient fluid, and the status of the recycling systems became the true measure of everything. The slow countdown to nothing, the only clock which mattered. Then, with an abruptness of a gunshot, the journey ended. The rocket exploded 10 meters in front of War Anvil. Earth fountained up. War Anvil rolled on, the debris falling on its hull. The order to arm weapons began to form in his mouth, but he already knew they were dead. Saul and Kogetsu were in the side sponsons, but the main guns were cold and empty.
"Multiple heat signatures,"
called Arrigo over the vox.
"Where the hell did they come from?"
shouted Saul.
"I can't see them,"
Kogetsu yelled.
"I count six," said Arrigo. "But their signal identifiers say they are..."
"Unknown units, halt now and power down,"
the voice cut across the vox.
"We have clear shots and will not warn you again before I fire."
Cord recognized something in its low tones, something that rolled cold down his spine. He cut the drive power, and War Anvil came to a juddering halt.
"Comply," he said into the command vox. "Stop and power down."
"We are still,"
said Arrigo a second later.
"This is Colonel Cord of the Talon 71st. We have complied."
He took a breath and tried to make his voice reflect the title he had just invoked, rather than the reality he felt.
"Now identify yourselves."
"Your weapons are still charged and ready, Colonel. You have 10 seconds to undo that."
"All weapons cold now,"
Cord roared.
"Colonel,"
began Saul.
"Now!"
Cord waited. He had not counted, but after what seemed like a long time, the cold voice growled across the vox again.
"You will give reasons for your presence."
"Who are you?"
Cord closed his eyes and let out a breath.
"Colonel."
It was Shornal.
Their identifier signals are green. They're with us.
Allies who open a conversation by shooting, said Saul.
Silence, said Cord.
They all caught the sharpness in his voice. A leaden silence waited for him as he opened his eyes.
We are seeking sanctuary, he said into the external vox. We have taken casualties, are undercrewed, underarmed, and running low on water, food, and air.
You do not know where you are? Asked the voice.
Not precisely.
Cord let out a slow breath, considered not asking the question which had been rolling over in his mind ever since he had first heard the challenge come across the vox.
What legion are you from?
A pause. A long, ringing pause.
The 10th?
10th Legion, he thought. One of the sons of the dead Primarch. One of the Iron Hands.
My name is Manetius, said the Iron Hand, and I give you greetings.
As if to accompany the words, a low, dark metal shape slid into Cord's field of view. It was a predator, its oil-black lines rubbed with dust. Las cannons hung from its flanks. Cord recognized the focusing plates of a conversion beamer running down the barrel of its main gun.
You will follow, said Manetius.
Where to?
You have found what you seek, at least in part. You are come to the Ratchab, Colonel. You will have safety there. Though, if you will leave again, is another question.
He woke first to the memory of his father's voice.
Do you know our creed?
Perturabo had turned to look into the distance of the machine-filled cavern. Herend had hesitated, the words coming in halting bites from his speaker grills.
From iron cometh strength. From strength cometh will. From will cometh faith. From faith cometh honour. From honour cometh iron.
Those are the words. But what do they mean?
Asked Perturabo, his chin dipping into the collar of his armour, the skin of his face contracting around his stare.
That we never break?
That we never break.
The Primarch nodded, and then looked back to Herend.
But what if we have already broken?
For a second he could not believe that he had heard those words. Then they began to seep in. They felt like poison. Perturabo watched Herend, black eyes unblinking.
Master,
Herend began,
What if we were broken long ago? What if the choices we made and the trust we gave made our iron rust, our strength weakness, our honour false? What do those words mean then?
They become a lie, he said.
Perturabo nodded slowly.
They become a lie, echoed the Primarch.
But we have never broken.
Our word, our trust, our chains, our dreams.
A flicker passed through the depths of his eyes.
Which of these remains unbroken?
And Herend woke a second time to the voices of his brothers.
He endures yet.
The voice was Yarvak, hard-edged, neither pleased nor disappointed, a blunt statement stamping the truth on reality. He lay beneath a ceiling of red and orange clouds. It was not a kind waking. There was pain, true pain, crawling up his nerves from damaged systems, the sharp feeling of broken bones and seeping wounds. Both his machine frames and his true flesh were hurt. The sensations overlapped, contradicted, chimed against one another, pulling his existence between two realities. Bit by bit, his senses cleared. He became aware of the others, their presence blotches of signals and heat encircling him. Four war machines and a single dreadnought, all arranged in a circle with him at the centre. They had taken four casualties then, the three predators and one of his dreadnought brothers. More important than this tally was what had survived. Spartan 4171 was still intact, as was the drill machine. They still had Hestal. They still had a guide to lead them through the Lost Land. He began to test his motive system, and then to stand. They were still in the valley. The fires had contracted back to individual wrecks, each one a white stain on his heat vision. He switched to standard sight. The image jumped, scattered into fragments, and then settled. The black bones of heat-distorted hulls flickered at the heart of the fires. His targeting array remained offline, but he counted the fires with a glance. The count matched the enemy strength. No survivors, as it should be. He turned where he stood and looked at the surviving machines of the Silaros. None of them were unmarked by battle. Yarvak's Sycharan had been washed by flame, and soot skinned its hull. He noted Gortun's absence, and deduced that one of the heaps of wreckage must be his brother in iron. It was unfortunate, but merely one factor in their reduced strength. They would be low on ammunition, and this far from the sightless warren, there was no way to resupply. No matter, they had to continue. He wondered if the other search groups sent by the Primarch had begun to die like this, not in one moment, but eaten away bit by bit. The Silaros waited, silent, measuring his strength, judging if he had weakened enough to let the damage drag him into failure.
"Navigator," he said.
"I see and hear," said Hestal.
"Does the path lead as it did?"
"The path leads where it has always led."
Herend cut the vox without reply and took a step forward, then another and another. Pain followed each movement, but he did not stumble. After three paces, the pain was a simple fact. The rest of the war machines opened their circle and followed him as he walked through the fires and towards the pass across the mountains. The alarms began to shout as the platform rose up the shaft. Argonis snapped around to look at Sota Nul.
"What? Full security alert in progress, cause unknown."
"We are blown."
"Possibly. That is not a certainty."
The platform clanged to a halt. The strips illuminating the shaft cut out.
"And now?"
growled Argonis, pulling back to a corner, gun up, head twisting to track entry points.
"Our detection is looking more probable."
Taldak stirred on the floor. Argonis glanced at him and up at Prophesius. He began to form a command. Hatches blew out in the shaft above. Smoke billowed in. Heavy figures dropped onto the platform. Argonis's eyes lit with target markers. His finger held still on the trigger, will overriding instinct. Sota Nul whirled, hissing, arcs of blue power spitting from her.
"No!"
shouted Argonis. The deck rang under the impact of armored boots. He saw the shapes of slab shields and the smear of red light from the eyes behind them. A buzzing fizz filled the air, and Sota Nul slammed to the floor, sparks and cords of electricity flickering over her as she tried to rise. Argonis recognized the sound and effect of a graviton gun. He did not lower his weapon, but he did not move either. At his back, Prophesius was scratching out words on his tablet, but Argonis did not turn his gaze to see what the astropath was writing. Armored figures and a wall of shields surrounded him. The muzzles of the guns slotted through each held steady on his chest. Sudden silence filled the lift shaft, broken only by the buzz of active power armor. The low light and still clinging smoke hid the details of the encircling warriors, but the way they had moved and the details of their posture spoke to who and what they were. The elite shield troops of the Iron Warriors.
"Lower the weapon, emissary," said a heavy voice from behind the ring of Iron Warriors.
It was Volk. Argonis could hear the flatness in his words. Some called the Iron Warriors callous, and he supposed that from a point of view they were, but he had fought with them and seen the root of that quality. It was not pride, or because of stunted self-worth. It was simply that they would not let anything stand between them and what they needed to do. He lowered his weapon. The shield wall surged forward. They pulled the bolter from his hands, the sword from his waist, and the pistol from his thigh. Not once did he have space to move. The three guns covered him at all times. Thorough, precise, just as he would expect from the 4th Legion. Once they were done, they stepped back, so that Volk could step forward. He was helmed, but his hands were empty.
"I am the emissary of your war master," growled Argonis.
Volk just stared at him. Argonis fancied that there was more than anger in that stare. The Iron Warrior began to turn away.
"What are the Black Oculus?"
called Argonis. Volk froze. "The unlogged missions to the surface? What are they looking for?" Volk turned his glowing red gaze back. Behind him, Sotanul twitched on the floor, limbs sparking as they tried to move.
"You have hidden things from me. You have hidden them from the War Master. Why are you here, old friend?"
"Take them,"
said Volk at last. And the ranks of Iron Warriors closed around Argonis like a fist. The kill team came for Io 3 days after she watched the Iron Warriors take Argonis. She was in a sump shaft which ran between levels of the shelter, draining extraneous moisture down to filter tanks in the deep earth. As wide as 2 battle tanks, it was a black void of mould and damp, dank air. Access to the shaft was by heavy inspection hatches, which could only be reached by crawling through passages. Rusting metal cleats dotted the inside of the shaft. Io hung from the side of the shaft from 2 of the cleats, muscles locked, the pain of the exertion deleted from her awareness. She had been hanging in the dark for 2 hours when the attack began. The first sign of the attack was the sound of the photon flash grenade arming as it fell from above. She snapped her head up and around in time for the world to become a blinding white. Her eyes responded an instant before her mind processed it. Her irises contracted to nothing, blanking out the blinding light. Even then a frozen ghost scar hung on her retina. "Data, photon flash, time detonation to descent." Her eyes opened to see 5 figures running down the sides of the shaft above her. Black rope lines trailed above them. Her recovering eyes caught the lines of hard, compact armor, vision visors and gun barrels. She sprang from the wall. Something hit the rockcrete where her head had been. Dust and glittering metal globules scattered from the impact. "Data, stalker pattern rounds, secondary gas propellant, mercury-filled heads." She hit the opposite wall of the shaft and kicked away. The armored figures fired. The sound of their guns was a stuttered purr. She caught a projecting cleat, then flipped back over as rounds exploded in silver clouds around her. She could see the attackers clearly now. They were space marines, but their armor was the compact, unpowered armor used by Legion recon units. They fired without pause, driving her down, the beaters driving her towards the executioners. It was a clever tactic, well executed, and with gravity on its side. She flipped from the wall and dropped into the darkness. Above her, the 5 shooters cut their rope lines as one and dropped after her. Anti-grav units lit with a ringing hum. That was good. She had predicted correctly. Air rushed past her, the dark beneath roaring as it came up to meet her. After 100 meters, she splayed her limbs. Membranes of sin skin between her arms, body and legs caught the air, and she snapped to stillness. The lead warrior, falling after her, reacted too slowly. His bulk slammed into her, but she was ready. Her limbs ripped around him. Her hand came up under his chin. The digi-needler spat a sliver up under his jaw. A spray of rounds burst silently in front of her. Above and around her, the falling figures were cutting their fall, anti-grav fields hissing in the damp air. "Data. Recon-configured troops of the Legionis Astartes commonly carry secondary armaments on the right thigh and or holstered across the chest." Her hand found the power knife strapped to the dead warrior. She activated it in the sheath and ripped it out and upwards, carving through armor, flesh and bone. She jumped from the dead warrior a second before a stalker round hit where she had been. The round blew the back of his head out. The fizzing power blade in her right hand cast shadows around her as she fell. Below her she heard a sound like a sharp breath and knew that she had been right again. A second team were waiting beneath her. "Data, flamer unit ignition sound." She dropped the grenades and snapped her sin-skin membranes out again, tucked her knees, and flipped over as the air caught her. Stalker rounds thudded after her. In her left hand, she held a bandolier of grenades she had taken from the dead warrior. She had pulled the pins in time sequence before she had jumped from the corpse. The warrior she had killed had carried 4 grenades, 2 photon flashes, 2 fragmentation charges. She dropped the 2 flashes and a single frag down the shaft. The other frag she had left on the corpse that was still spinning in slowed gravity above. On cue, the world flashed to white beneath her. A second later, she heard the simultaneous roars of frag detonations above and below her. Shrapnel rang off the rockcrete walls. She heard the secondary thump of a flame fuel cell exploding, and the air around her became a sea of fire. The edge of the blast waves hit her from both sides. She really was falling now, uncontrolled, tumbling over as she tried to reason out which way was up. Her brain did what it always did in times of extreme stress. It went cold. On reflection, things had occurred within predicted parameters. The Alpha Legion attack had been superbly orchestrated. If she had not been waiting for it, it might have succeeded. For a second, she wondered if it had been within acceptable risk-reward parameters. Increased risk-taking was another known consequence of prolonged, unbounded deployment. But it came back to the oldest of paradoxes. What other choice had she had? The problem was information, or rather its lack. Io's mind drank information, and its thirst was never quenched. There was always more information to consume. Even confined to a featureless white room, the textures of walls and the angles of surfaces could spawn endless datasets. One of the first stages of initiation in the Vanus Temple was to be drowned in data. Presented with an endless source of data, initiates would gorge themselves to the point of seizure. The lesson in that experience was about selection. Data on its own was just chaos without form. Selection and exclusion gave data shape, gave it use. Io knew this, but her hunger was not just for more data, but for very specific information. What were the Alpha Legion doing, and what did they know? Those questions were now the unknown edges of her calculations. Without answers, she could not extend her projections. Without answers, she could not sense the potential of any of her actions. She now knew something of what the Iron Warriors were doing and what they were hiding, but that data only became useful if she knew who else knew that secret. So she had begun a separate operation to get an answer from the Alpha Legion, and she had used the only lure she could. Herself. She opened her eyes and found that the shaft above her was still alight. Liquid fire clung to the shaft walls. A second later, the shaft walls disappeared, and she was falling towards a black mirror of water under the roof of a rock cavern. She cut her speed before she hit the water. As the water closed over her, she heard the voices of the surviving members of the team sent to kill her.
"She is still active! Too much noise. We have to pull out now."
3 of the kill team had survived. An acceptable number. More than enough to carry the net flies that already clung to them under the edges of armour and in the folds of weapon pouches.
"Send a signal. Termination failed."
"She is good,"
said one of them, a bitter edge of admiration in her voice.
"Yeah," said the other. "Too good."
As she sank deeper into the sump water, Io smiled.